Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Long-term trends and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things Marine.
Welcome aboard to the Father's Day edition of Midrats. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever genial and present Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder of those who are with us live, make sure and scroll down to the chat room at the bottom. Keep Boston Maggie company. She's actually showed up on time for a change and waiting for your clear observations. Eagle One will be writing herd on the chat room, so if we go through the show, if you have some observations, some questions that you want to bring up, fold them into the chat room. Eagle One will snag them, and we'll bring them right on board. Hey, so let's go ahead and get on with the show. As you all know, today's subject is going to be command at sea. We're going to have a real broad-ranging discussion here about, you know, what does that mean? What does it take to do it? What does it take to succeed? But more importantly, what are the responsibilities that you see when you are at command at sea? Our guests today will be three present or former Navy and Coast Guard commanding officers. We have Commander Ed Westfall, U.S. Coast Guard commanding officer of the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Escanaba. We're going to have Commander James H. Ware. He's the commanding officer of VAQ 135. And Commander Michael Yunga. He is the former commanding officer of the USS Whidbey Island LSD 41. Now, for those who may be new to Midrats, if you want to catch up on the shows you've missed, or if you want to hear this again, as always, go over to Blog Talk Radio for the archive and get yourself set up. You can also get us on iTunes. Let's quick background on our first guest, Commander Ed Westfall. In addition to being the commanding officer of the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Escanaba, and when you listen to the bio for you Navy guys, I want to have you listen to this, because one of the things I want to talk with Ed is the way the Coast Guard gets their commander command set up the way they do. But not to get too far ahead of myself, Commander Westfall, he received his bachelor's degree from the State University of New York back in 1997. He also has a master's in public administration from Rutgers from back in 2003. He started off enlisted in the Coast Guard back in the early of 1985. He was on the rush, and he departed as a quartermaster first class in late 88. He also served aboard the cutter Sapelo, and with Coast Guard Group San Francisco, where he advanced to quartermaster chief. Back in September of 1991, he completed officer candidate school. He since then has served on the Ironwood and as the executive officer of the Red Cedar. I believe he also commanded the Red Cedar for a while until her decommissioning and transfer to the Argentine Navy. And following that, he was the first commanding officer of the cutter William Tate. His most recently afloat command prior to Escanaba was Coast Guard cutter Aspen, that was stationed in his hometown of San Francisco, which makes you automatically respect his ability to work with the Coast Guard detailers because he keeps returning to his hometown, something some of us could never do. But ashore, Commander Westfall served as the lighthouse manager and assistant chief of the waterways management section for the 5th Coast Guard District. And he also served as the service operations officer for JIATF West, and also the assistant Coast Guard attaché in Mexico City for 2 years. He's also been a member of the deployable liaison team for the Federal Emergency Management Agency in the Mid-Atlantic region. Ed, welcome to Midrats.
Well, Sal, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you very much for taking some time to come in. And you'll bring a tear to a few people's eyes because Commander Westfall, he is calling in via MRSAT, but it's a pretty strong connection. Everything should be well. And Ed, I kind of teed up my first question to you because when you look at your bio, you know, here you are at Commander Command, and you already have a lot of experience commanding Coast Guardsmen at sea and commanding ships. Just icing on the cake, it's great to see a commanding officer who has also been a chief. But one thing that we've lost in a few decades in the Navy is there used to be quite a few lieutenant commands and lieutenant commander commands, and I worked for a flag officer who, when you looked at his bio, he had command as lieutenant, lieutenant commander, commander, captain. So he really had a lot of experience in command. If you could, for a second, for you know, most of our audience are Navy types, talk to how the Coast Guard grooms its leaders and your opportunities for command as you go forward.
Okay, well, that's certainly a good question. Honestly, my my career path has been a little unusual. It's not completely out of the norm. In fact, our current Commandant Admiral Papp actually has a command path up to and including his 05 command that is not dissimilar. But a lot of our opportunities for command at the at other than the 05 level earlier on involves an assignment to the buoy tender in the 8th Navigation Fleet, which is a little bit of a different mission set in terms of primary mission. We do have a fair amount of commands at the lieutenant and lieutenant commander level across the board, but there are a lot of folks out there who achieve their first command at sea at the 05 level, having done kind of the traditional progression through the junior officer afloat, then the department head afloat, then the XO, and then finally command at the commander level.
Eagle One.
Well, as you've got a lot of experience in different commands, what have you found to be the most important, as you look back on the most important experience prior to taking command? What would you try and get another officer to do if you were grooming him for command?
Oh boy, there are so many that I
would only ask
the,
easy
the
questions.
Most, well, exactly, and I understand that as a semi-regular listener, although I am behind a few shows, but the thing that I think is most important you have to develop, of course, the leadership skills, all that. Which, there are various ways of doing that, both in terms of exposure to the theoretical, but the most important being the practical application. Learning that, building upon your experiences. But I think the thing I really look for in terms of trying to groom folks to, succeed in higher responsibilities, I'm looking for them to have a healthy dose of professional curiosity. Obviously, you want people who, demonstrate good judgment. Quite frankly, I think everybody who serves in command needs to have a healthy ego, not too much of an ego, but a healthy one, coupled with humility at the same time. Ability to listen, appreciation for the value of a good and healthy command climate, communication up and down the chain. All those things kind of play into it, but I think... if you can wrap all that into a package, I think you're setting people well on their way.
Another thing that I've kind of admired Coast Guard from a distance, we've tried to reinvent the term over on the Navy side of house, talking about hybrid sailors, but when you look at your Coast Guardsmen, you can have a crew that is doing dedicated counter-narcotics one day, and then the next day, they're going into oil and environmental issues. There's also your usual enforcement issues that the Coast Guard does as well. And I think you can also see it at the top of your chain with Admiral Allen, is he runs the Coast Guard at one point, and then especially we saw in the first month and a half of the problem that we're having with oil down in the Gulf, is he was a constant presence. From a leadership and an information point of view with that respect. What type of training do y'all do to keep your primary mission areas, so to speak, up to speed and your sailors ready to pivot on a moment's notice? And I mentioned a few there, but if you had to pick your top three primary mission areas in a Coast Guard cutter that you want you and your Coast Guardsmen really to have ready to go, what would those three be?
Probably the biggest three that for the Escanaba I need to be ready to, like you say, spin on a dime to do are going to be a homeland security type of a scenario. Something very bad happens or threatens to happen. A search and rescue, and then a law enforcement type of a scenario for the Escanaba's mission set. But one of the things that I think is sometimes lost is there's some commonality amongst all those in terms of bringing specific skills and talents to what you're doing. One of the things that's been my growing observation over time is that, the term's evolved, but what I think everybody with a joint warfare background will understand is the battle space or battle space awareness. In so many of the Coast Guard's missions, knowing who's on the water doing what and where they are is really a fundamental piece of that, up to and including search and rescue.
Eagle One.
Well, I'm going to go back to some training of junior officer issues, but I mean, when you started out in your first command, have you gone on a staircase? Have you increased your ability to command with the more commands you've had? Do you see that junior level command as playing an important role in your career?
Absolutely, and as important, and not everybody's path follows this, although most people do. As important was my XO tour. I was fortunate that I got to be an XO of a Coast Guard cutter with, I think it was roughly 33 people, including a wardroom of about five, including my warrant officers. But I got to do that at the Lieutenant JG level, and that was certainly a key pillar to further growth. But you know, as I've progressed through commands of different sizes and ever-expanding mission and AORs, it has definitely been a steady state type of a staircase step of growth. And I do think that, for me, that command at the more junior level has just helped prepare me more and more as I've increased in the size and scope of the command.
I've also noticed, not just in your time at sea, but your time ashore, it's very operationally focused. There's an ongoing issue that we have with leadership development in the Navy where there's a lot of distractions, so to speak, between when you're a JO, then when you're out coming up for commander command, to the point that on the aviation side of the house, we have commanding officers who have as many flight hours now that a mid-grade junior officer used to have, because there's, quote, more important, unquote, things they need to do from a career progression point of view than to go be operational. Do y'all have a similar challenge that y'all working in the Coast Guard, or have y'all hit a groove where you're really happy on what at least appears from the outside to be an operational focus in your career path?
I think we tend to face similar challenges to what you're describing in the Navy. I would agree with your description that I've had a pretty operationalized career background, and of, I think, considerable note in that is, yes, I, you know, achieved my bachelor's, which was done on my own time, converting a lot of my Coast Guard stuff into college credits. My master's degree I had to do on my own time. A lot of the classwork was while I was in command, and I've also completed the Naval War College Distance Education Program, which was a great program and something I always point my folks to. But I did that, again, most of that work, actually all that work I did while I was in command of the Aspen. So I've had to work hard to achieve some of the educational stuff that I do think is important, but yet still go to sea or be operational.
Eagle One.
If I'm not sure if you had, given all you've been doing on your command time, I'm not sure you've had enough time to look at books on people who've had command at sea. But if you have you got a book that you think really highlights what the position of a commanding officer is, and that you look to every now and then for guidance?
Oh well. And I will confess that, I do have to make time to read, and I do probably not enough. And actually, as was transparent to your listeners, but as you guys know, I met the call-in time for the show about 24 seconds ahead of the show start, and that had to do with some phone challenges on my end, so I ended up in a stateroom rather than in the CO's cabin, so I don't have my bookshelf handy. So rather than butcher the titles of books that I've got up there that I've looked at, I will tell you that even the good old Naval Institute Press Commanded Sea Pub is a good place to start. For Coast Guard missions, I'll tell you Coast Guard Pub 1, which is our just capstone fundamental doctrinal pub, I think for a Coast Guard commanding officer is really important to look at, because I think it really helps put into perspective, if you're paying attention to it, it's putting into perspective what I think you need to remember as a CO. Because as a CO, it's very easy to get distracted and start focusing on the tactical, which of course you want to succeed at and have to remain focused on. But when you're talking about mission and mission execution, I think it's very important to have that more operational and strategic level, both in a geographic sense, but also in a timeline sense, because it's very, it's like any time management thing. It's very easy to get distracted by the urgent and not worry about the important, when it's the important is what matters.
I'm also, in addition to being a book geek, I got real excited when Eagle One asked you that question. I was starting to write them down. I'm also kind of a history harpy, in that I'm a big fan of what history has, not only to teach us, but to give us a reason to pause. And the Cutter Escanaba does something I think is really neat every June. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's June 13th. Something special happens on your ship. Could you tell the readers about that? Oh, listeners, excuse me.
Yes, absolutely. You got the date right. June 13th, 1943, the first Cutter Escanaba sank, was blown up in a scenario that reminds me a little bit of some very recent events, but in any event, escorting a convoy off of Greenland. And the belief was she was torpedoed, but could have been a mine, but belief was she was torpedoed, and everyone but two perished. The other ships that were escorting got there as quick as they could, and that's all they were able to recover. The current Escanaba is actually the third one to bear the name. The second one served the Coast Guard well, and honestly, the disposition of the whole I don't know at the moment. But the third Escanaba, every June 13th, we assemble the crew and read the story as to what happened and the loss of the initial of the first Escanaba, and lay a wreath in the ocean wherever we may be. We just did that last week. Up until a couple of years ago, the last remaining survivor of the sinking of the first Escanaba was Ray O'Malley, and that tradition had been to had the captain of the Escanaba called Mr. O'Malley up and informed him that the crew was well, the ship was well, and that all remember the sacrifices made by that by all of Mr. O'Malley's shipmates that morning.
That's a great story, and a great thing, I'm sure, is a skipper of a ship to be able to do every year. And we got time enough with Commander Westfall for one more question. Eagle One, over to you.
Well, I'm going to ask a question that one of our listeners posted, and what did you find to be the most difficult aspect of making the transition from chief to chief's mess to the wardroom?
My ensign tour was probably painful. Well, not probably. It was definitely a painful transition for me. I think there are a lot of perspectives of it, and of course, in my own self-centered way at the time, I perceived that that although the challenge was mine, the problems were all somebody else's fault. That gets to that humility piece. I think the shift from understanding that you are, if you will, a senior and experienced but technical expert, and transitioning into what ultimately becomes that you know, your responsibility of leading, and certainly at the ensign level, you're just beginning to glean this, but that your responsibility for leading and understanding things that at some point can have a national impact, and certainly if you're paying attention, you understand how what you're doing fits into the global role or the global level. I think that humility and in some ways rebooting your career and your perspective is a humbling experience, absolutely. And I would say that was a challenge for me to work through.
And Ed, Sal again, boy, I think we could have gone on for the whole time. But thank you very much for taking 20 minutes out of your time, stealing somebody else's stateroom, and using up some MRSAT time to come up on MIDRATS.
Well, Sal, I'm very happy to have been able to do so, and thanks again for inviting me. I'm a fan of all your blogs. Certainly read them. They are a good way to spark discussion and do some of that professional growth and professional curiosity stuff I talk about for my not just my junior officers, but myself included and my enlisted folks as well. So it they always spark conversations and get some good dialogue going, and I think that's a very important thing. So thanks again, and good luck with the rest of the show.
Thank you very much, Ed, and please pass on our best wishes to your Coast Guardsmen. Okay, everybody, we're going to shift over to our second guest today. He is Commander James H. Ware III. He is a commanding officer of VAQ-135, flying the EA-6B, also known as the squadron is known as the Black Ravens. Commander Ware attended Pennsylvania State University in 1987, and he graduated from the United States Naval Academy, shifted over, back in 1992 with a Bachelor of Science degree in Systems Engineering. He's completed tours of VAQ-131, also VAQ-129, which for you aviators out there is the EA-6B FRS. He is a graduate of the Navy Test Pilot School and a member of the Naval Strike Aircraft Test Squadron. He also earned his master's degree in Systems Engineering from Johns Hopkins University. He then served in VAQ-132 and now VAQ-135. He was deployed at sea on board the USS Constellation and the USS John F. Kennedy, and I believe he also owned the USS Truman. I'm sure Tupper will fix me if I'm wrong on that. He has over 3,000 flight hours and 797 carrier arrested landings, and the good thing about test pilot school, he also piloted over 23 different types of aircraft. He also has served ashore from Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia to Stuttgart, Germany, at the United States European Command. Commander Ware, welcome to MIDRATS.
Well, thank you, Sal. Appreciate you having me.
Great. We can't have too much of a surface focus here. Our aviator friends will get all upset. One thing I noticed when we resumed show prep here is you just brought your squadron back, and I believe in March, from an 8-month deployment. When y'all headed out, did you think you were going on a 6-month, or did you know that you're going ahead of an 8-month deployment? And is there something working with your sailors in your squadron where when you do more of a 6-month deployment from a leadership point of view, it makes it a little more of a challenge?
Yeah, we work backwards. We got back on March 21st from an 8-month combat deployment where we flew over in support of Operation Enduring Freedom, Afghanistan, from the USS Nimitz. We left the good port of San Diego towards the end of July of last year, and we thought it was going to be a 6-month cruise. In the back of some of our minds, we suspected with the troubles that the Enterprise was having in the yards that, you know, the writing was on the wall. Somebody's going to get extended, and maybe more than one carrier. So we began, I began early on preparing for that and putting that message out at the deck plate of, hey, we could get extended. And then when it did come to fruition, we were ready. So.
Eagle One.
Well, I got two questions. One, the first one is, why couldn't you get 3 more landings on a carrier to get 800? And secondly, I'm going to ask you the same kind of question that I asked our previous guest, which is what kind of preparation do you view as being the best for becoming CO of a squadron?
Well, thanks, Eagle One. I'm not dead yet, so I will get those three traps plus more in August when we go back out. I would have to say that, you know, for aviators, it's a little bit different. Our training track is a bit longer. It took me 3 years to get through flight school, and that was back in the days where there were some delays, and my pipeline was unique. I was the last T2 class in Kingsville, and then we went up to PCS'd up to Meridian and flew the A4. And so I was a little bit of an exception, but the standard rule does apply that most junior officers getting to their first fleet squadron, they've spent so much time just learning how to fly the jet, and now they continue to try to learn and grow in that fleet airframe that, you know, on the surface warfare side, for example, your average surface warfare JG will have a lot more leadership experience than a pilot or an NFO will. So we have some catching up to do. I was fortunate to be the maintenance officer in VAQ-132 before my XO and CO tour, and being the MO, the maintenance officer of, you know, 130 hard charge and aircraft maintainers, did help prepare me for what lay in store. You know, another thing I think we do well in naval aviation is we fleet up, and so we'll go in as XO of VAQ-135 in my example. And then when we take over and we're the commanding officer, we know the personalities, we know most of the issues, and it's more of a seamless transition, I think. So as far as, you know, qualities of a person, I remember you asking the previous CO that question. I was writing down some notes. I think the most important quality that a commanding officer can have is courage, the courage to do what's right, regardless of the consequences. But I think another important quality is, I don't even know if this is a word, but unflappability. The ability when the world is kind of caving in around you to be absolutely steadfast and unflappable, you know, to maintain that even keel and to give the ship some rudder. So,
one thing about the EA-6B community compared to a lot of the aviation community where it'll be split, you know, East Coast, West Coast, and there can be people who develop an East Coast flavor or West Coast flavor. With the Prowler community, you're all located there in Whidbey Island. So I would assume by the time you get leveled, get up to the level of command, y'all know each other fairly well, if not been in squadrons together. At least in sister squadrons, and you're, you know, 1 degree of separation away. Does that type of familiarity help in command? Is there a little more of continuity and camaraderie because everybody is located there for their careers, or is there a little bit of a dark side to that that makes it more of a challenge?
I'd say both. You're exactly right, and it's very insightful to point that out. With the exception of VAQ-136, our four-deployed squadron in Japan, and the Marines who fly the EA-6B out of Cherry Point, we can deploy east or west coast, but we're all homeported here in Whidbey. And so we do form, you know, we're a tight community, and that's one of the hallmarks that I think has made the Prowler community great is up and down the flight line, the few squadrons that are actually here, but, you know, when we are back in home port, we always help each other out. And with an aging airframe, wow, you need to. You know, parts, people, that's just, we actually call that the Whidbey team spirit. I know it sounds trite, but it's actually a phrase. The dark side of that is, you know, it's a small community. And so if you don't play well with others, you can get a reputation pretty quick, and usually that's fairly well deserved. But the people who do, generally speaking, you know, survive in naval aviation, survive in this business, we do play well with others, and there's a great camaraderie up here.
Eagle One.
Well, one of the listeners has posed a question, which is a pretty good one. Is a 30-month XOCO tour the right length of time? I think he goes on to ask, is a 15-month CO tour, 12 months for the VP squadrons too short? You got any feels for that?
I can't really speak to the P3 piece. For myself, I think that the optimal command tour is somewhere between 38 and 40 years. And so I think I've got about 36 years to be the commanding officer. When the FAA tells me I can't fly anymore, that's probably when I need to hang it up. So my XO is going to have to push me out the door kicking and screaming. No, I don't think 15 months is the right length. I think it ought to be longer. And the reasons why it's 15, they're there. It used to be 18, and before that it was 24. Probably the right length of time is 18 to 24 months. Now, I have noticed that, you know, especially on the enlisted side, sailors up in Whidbey Island who want to homestead here, and there are shrinking shore duty opportunities up here. So if you desire that family continuity, you know, you will get a second, third, first class or a chief that will bounce from flight line squadron to flight line squadron. That translates into a heck of a lot of sea duty, but it also equals a lot of quality of life for the family. And so from that perspective, I've seen sailors extend in my command, and I've had to watch that actually kind of closely, because I do feel that there is an optimal sea length tour for the Blue Jackets, and you can be in a squadron for too long, and then you just need to go. That's simply to get a fresh look. You know, in the business of aviation and aviation maintenance, it's a dangerous and unforgiving business, and we can't ever become complacent or take things for granted. And so an organization that has leadership that has been there, either whether it's at the chief level or at the commanding officer level, you know, you can build some habits, and not all habits are good. And so the changing of the guard serves a very valuable purpose in my mind.
What's the, Tupper, the another thing about the VAQ community that was brought out with much fanfare a while back, is there the joint nature of the Prowler community with the Air Force's involvement. Where does that stand right now? And looking at it from a side angle, how do you view that?
Well, we had four, now we have three expeditionary squadrons here at Whidbey Island. These expeditionary squadrons are comprised of a few Air Force aircrew, but it's predominantly Navy presence. These expeditionary squadrons will deploy with an Air Force wing, and you know, notably, they are on the ground in Bagram or Al-Asad, but increasingly our focus is moving to Afghanistan, and they integrate with the Air Force. I have never been in an expeditionary squadron, but you know, you pointed out in the bio, VAQ-131, my first squadron, we gap-filled an expeditionary requirement. So I spent more than a few months on the ground in PSAB, Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia, flying missions in support of then Operation Southern Watch. It's an interesting experience working with the Air Force. I think the Air Force is politically savvy to keep their toe in the electronic attack business. I think that you know, there is a move afoot now to push some of the first EA-18G squadrons into the expeditionary role. And I think that's going to be interesting to see how that works. I think the desire is to get that new weapons system and that platform into the fight as soon as possible.
Eagle One.
We just had the chance a couple of weeks ago to interview the author of the book Such Men as These, which is about the Navy pilots in the Korean War. And I was wondering if impressive book, impressed with the aviators and the SWO myself. I really haven't had that much to do with them, other than the fact my son is he's a Navy helicopter pilot. But are there books that you look to as kind of guidance in, or inspiration for, as your job as a CO?
Yes. And, you know, I have to give credit to my my XO, Vinny Johnson, as well. He is he and I see eye to eye on darn near anything, and he is a thinker. He's introduced me to Admiral Stockdale's writings, and through that I've gotten more and more into the Stoic philosophy, the philosophers Plato and others. And what I admire most about the Stockdale writings are his absolute resolution and his understanding that your actions are your own, and in spite of the external pressures placed upon you, your decision on how you react is not a result of those factors. It is a result of who you are as a person. Another book that I've really enjoyed, though, most recently was The Pursuit of Victory. It's essentially the life of Horatio Nelson. You talk about a stud. That guy had it, you know. We complain. I heard sailors complain about, you know, the extension from 6 to 8 months, although generally they absolutely, you know, took it with a smile on their face. But you read about, you know, Nelson not setting foot off of his 300-foot, you know, shipped for 365 days, 380 days, and that's just incredible. You know, I spent eight straight months on an aircraft carrier with some port calls in between, so you know, it's all in perspective.
And you're not walking around with one arm and one eye either, there, Skipper. So you're doing all right. When you look at transitioning from
I don't have malaria either.
Yeah, you got, and you're immune to smallpox. I assume you got the shot.
times 10.
One thing that, and darn it, I'd like to beat a PAO sometimes because I think they toot the wrong horns. But one of the great untold stories of this conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan has been the electronic attack community's ability. You saw them come in early on, scratch their noggin and say, we can do this for you, and it's progressed from there. But y'all have been responsible for saving so many soldiers, Marines, allies, everybody on the ground through your support of the mission overland. If you could for a second, could you just toot the horn there of your missions, your air crew, without going into exhaustive details, but tell everybody what y'all do there and the results y'all been able to see.
Yeah, well, thanks. I appreciate you pointing that out, and I can't tell you, you know, obviously most of the details about it, but it, because I was an OSW guy, you know, Operation Southern Watch. We poke guys in the eye. The radar operators. That's the traditional SEED, suppression of enemy air defenses mission. What do you do in a country where there are no air defenses, and what does your role become? And the acquisition community, is of which I was a part, has done a tremendous job in many ways of keeping the EA-6B viable and relevant in ways that, gosh, when I was a JO, I would not have even imagined. And so, you know, short of, as a matter of fact, VAQ-135 was the squadron that supported the strike in the Gulf of Sidra, you know, poking those radar operators in the eye. And I just wish sometimes I could go back and tell those guys what we're doing now over the skies of Afghanistan. Information operations is the name of the game, and I'll probably have to leave it at that. And I don't know how much, you know, Eagle One or Sal, y'all are familiar with what we did over Iraq, but we have changed the game even more now in Afghanistan. And so what we were doing in Iraq, we're not doing so much of that anymore in Afghanistan. It is shaped even to the next level. And we find ourselves ever more placed in, certainly a supporting role, but also a strategic role. We are a strategic national asset now. And, you know, low density, high demand. And I cannot tell you how rewarding it has been to get the feedback from the JTACs on the ground, you know, that will tell you, you guys showed up and this happened, and because of that, our guys are still walking around. I can't tell you what that means to us. So, you know, when we get feedback like that, an 8-month cruise goes by pretty quick.
Amen. Sometimes it's just enough to say, hey, they're there and they're doing it. Eagle One, we'll give you the last shot there.
Wow. Almost speechless. Thanks for your participation today with us. And as you look forward to the remaining time in your command, what do you really anticipate as being the something your sailors will remember you for?
I never lied to them. I always shot straight. That's been the most rewarding part of this job is changing, affecting sailors' lives. Because at the end of the day, you know, I'll be gone, and BAQ-135 will be a great squadron forever after. But it's the people along the way. It's not the ships. It's not the technology of the weapon system. It's the fighting spirit of every soldier, sailor, and Marine that make this country great. And that's why I'm here.
That's a great answer, and one that too often is ignored by commanding officers. Thank you very much.
No, thank you, sir.
Absolutely. And Commander Ware, thank you very much for coming on this afternoon. Send your best, our best wishes on to your sailors, and I wish you further success in command and going on.
Oh, thank you very much, Sal. I appreciate it. And I love the website. Again, it spurs a lot of discussion in our ready room, too. All the best.
Thank you very much. Okay, everybody, we are coming up to our third guest, and our third guest will be, and as pronounced in the correct German, Commander Michael Junge, United States Navy. He is the former commanding officer of the USS Whidbey Island. Commander Junge, he graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1990 with a degree in political science and with a minor in German. He also has a Master of Arts in Organizational Management from George Washington University and a Master of Arts in National and Strategic Studies from the Naval War College. At sea, he has served on the USS Moosbrugger, DD-980, also the USS Underwood, FFG-36. He was a navigator on the USS Wasp and XO of the USS DeSullivans. His most recent tour at sea was as the 14th commanding officer of the USS Whidbey Island, LSD-41. Ashore, he has served with the Navy recruiting and as a medical recruiter and officer in charge of Naval Recruiting and Processing Station San Juan, Puerto Rico. He's been with Assault Craft Unit 4 and also with the Deputy Commandant for Programs and Resources at the Headquarters of Marine Corps as an Expeditionary Program Analyst. He's also been Deputy Executive Assistant to the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Communications and Networks down at the N6 shop. He is currently assigned to the Office of the Secretary of Defense for the Rapid Reaction Technology Office as Emerging Capabilities Division Portfolio Manager for Maritime Technologies. Mike, welcome to MidRats.
Gentlemen, thanks for having me here.
Outstanding. Sorry to have you number three, but you're closest to us, so you get put at the back of the line.
Well, I hope that I can be as loose and coherent and well-spoken as the two previous gentlemen that were on.
We always try to set a high standard. The host makes them look good, I'll put it that way. Hey, what are the things about being in the good old Gator Navy as opposed to all the sexy guys as they describe themselves in the Aegis community is, as a commanding officer, you not only have to deal with sailors, but you also interact a lot with Marines, and you have to interface with their leadership. If you could for a minute, talk about how that works together on board a ship, especially when you have that full load of Marines with you.
Well, one of the more interesting things about my command tour of an LSD was that I spent more time doing DDG stuff than I did LSD missions. The deployment I did was 7 months, no Marine Corps. It was very unusual for LSDs to do that. I'd been in command almost 18 months by the time we embarked our first Marines. That was only for about a week or so to do workups for one of the other strike group ships, not a department head tour. And
you were robbed. I said no Marines. You were robbed.
Yeah, some would say that. Some would say it was the best thing in the world too. The thing with Marines are you have to remember that they are bored silly underway. All they have available really to do to them is some training because of limited space. They can work out, they can eat, and they can sleep. And that's it. So what do bored Marines do? Same thing other bored people do. They get in trouble, and they just try to fill their day. So the key thing with having seen them before is make sure they have a chance to work out, make sure they have as much training as you can do, try and keep the shipboard stuff from disrupting them too often, which is not easy because the ship's got to do their stuff. And you have to remind yourself and remind them that they are the reason your ship exists. For good or for ill, if we didn't have Marine Corps, we wouldn't have Gators.
Eagle One.
Well, I'm going to track along with my previous questions, Commander. What do you view as the best track, or what's a good track to become a commanding officer, and what do you look for in people you're grooming for that role?
Well, if I answered the way that most SWOs would answer, I would say, you got to do exactly what I did. This is what I did, and I became successful. And honestly, I completely disagree with that. I look for a varied career path. But at the same time, there's nothing wrong with being the guy that did nothing but destroyer to cruiser, destroyer to cruiser, destroyer to cruiser over the course of their career. But the key thing is making sure that you have learned enough to take with you the important rule sets that will serve you well in command. And to some degree, you got to kind of figure out what those rule sets are so you know what to take along with you. But the other part of it is, and the other two gentlemen hit on this very well, being yourself, being honest, having the fortitude and courage to do the right thing, those are all important command attributes. But you also need to pick up the technical ability to command a ship along the way. And that brings in some of those much less enjoyable things about life as a surface warfare officer. Everything from the maintenance system to damage control to pay and personnel to instruction writing, instruction reading. For me, the thing that worked best was enjoying the Navy, enjoying the job, and enjoying it well enough to learn those esoteric things that actually made the Navy run. It's not beans, bullets, and oil that get things from point A to point B. It's typically paper and now electrons. And if you don't know how that works, you're not going to do very well in command. Second part of that is you got to really know how to make people work. And the time to make your mistakes with people is as an ensign, JG, and lieutenant, not as a commander in command. We've seen far too many folks make mistakes in command. I was talking on Friday about one of them, and not be able to come through with it.
When you talk about the learning process in getting there, one thing that came to mind is when we were talking with Tupper there in the middle slot, and the aviation community has their you go in as XO and you fleet up to CO, and now we see the surface community doing the same thing. What are your thoughts about the fleet up concept? Are you fully on board with it, or do you have some reservations about it? And one way or another, what do you think that we're going to lose by moving away from our previous way of getting COs on ships?
By way of background, the primary author for Fleet Up was a former CO of mine. His boss was a former Commodore when I'd worked for that CO. And they gave me the opportunity to look at the Fleet Up plan a week or two before it came out to the rest of the world. And I'm looking at it and reading through it, and I'm thinking, I don't like this. There's something off about this idea. But it kept, niggling away at the back of my brain, and I thought about it. And about 3 days later, I emailed this CO and said, I like it, and here's why. And I'll get to some of the rest of it, but these are the things that are going to go away, I think. To largely go away. The tyrannical, mean, tactical, tomorrow must get done, or today must get done, I don't care about tomorrow, XOs are going to go away. And for two reasons. One is the guys that were able to burn the candle at both ends for 12 to 13 months during the 80s and early and 90s, because that's how short our tours were, aren't going to exist. You can't act that way for 18 months. It just doesn't work. And the second part is you can't act that way and then turn around and come into work one day as the captain and continue to act that way. You can't do 36 months as a tyrant. It will, in today's Navy, it won't be tolerated. And as those tyrants go away, I think we're going to find better retention amongst our women JOs. If we look at options, I personally believe that women have more options outside of the Navy than they do inside the Navy. And when we treat them like crap, they're going to look at it and go, all right, I'm going to go someplace else, in far greater numbers than the men do. And our retention for women among surface warfare is absolutely horrid for lots of reasons. And you covered a lot of them on your blog. But it shouldn't be as bad as it is. And I think we're going to see some of that go away. The last part I think that we're going to see increases in, but this takes a big Navy commitment as well. I think we'll see increases in our maintenance of ships, because if you're there for 3 years, you're going to see what's going on, and you're going to have a little more credibility as the CO a year into your tour who'd been the XO during the in-serve, and you can look at the port engineer and you can look Surfland or Surfpac in the eye and say, we had the in-serve, we had these problems. During the SRA, you underfunded them, and now we're going into our major availability, and you're funding them. You got to do something. The one danger with that is it's also pretty easy at that two-year mark to look at it and go, they screwed me once, they screwed me twice, this just sucks. Fighting that's going to be hard as we continue cutting our maintenance dollars, and that's a real challenge. Now, as to whether or not I'm fully on board with it, I am probably more on board with it than most of Navy leadership is today. We still have some problems with the cruisers and the cruiser COs, and the cruisers were the reason we didn't go to fleet up a long time ago. And this could be a while before we get that fixed. Inventory for captains just isn't where it is for what we need to make things work.
Eagle One.
Well, I have a question about the way surface warfare community tends to eat its young, as opposed to what the aviation community is doing. When you talk to Commander Ware, he's talking about when you're an aviator, you spend probably about 4 or 5 years with absolutely no responsibilities of learning to fly your aircraft. But at that same point for a SWO, you've had a number of FIT reps, all of which are rating you on your ability to manage people and to take care of your equipment and stuff. And that seems to me to put our SWOs sometimes at a disadvantage, because it takes a while to learn how to do that properly. Is there a way, as a CO, you try and counter that what tends to be a tendency to kill our young?
There's a couple of things. In my last OPNAV tour, I used to make the joke that by watching aviators, and there's a couple of folks that I know are out there listening right now, they're going to cringe when they hear me say this, but watching the senior aviation leadership from that time in the Pentagon, my prediction was that 5 or 6 years from now, we would have pilots wanting to lateral into SWO because SWOs were more stable and thought better than aviation leadership was. And the SWOs eating their young is such a stereotype that it persisted long through significant generational changes in the community, which were then completely offset by getting rid of the Surface Warfare Officer School Division Officer course up in Newport. And getting rid of that brought back a lot of the cultural mindset of we eat our young, because now we take them and throw them on board ship without any prior training at all. And that's bad. That's really bad. And we're getting a little better at going back and fixing that. But it's still, you get a fair number of ensigns that just show up on board a ship and are expected to know something. And the challenge for a CO, especially one who didn't go through that pipeline like that, is forgetting that they didn't have all that background training, that they didn't get walked through what the maintenance program is and how it works and how to do a spot check, and you have to rely entirely upon the chief petty officers to teach them. You have to take a look at the basics of administration, writing a naval message, writing a naval letter. None of that stuff is taught in the accession courses the way it needs to be. It's not reinforced at a training pipeline when it comes up. So for the first 6 months, anybody who comes on board is not starting off from any really good knowledge base. And it's been that way for about 5 years now. We've brought in a three-week course that helps fill some of those gaps in, but it's not as finished as it should be. And for the most part, until a division officer hits their second tour, they're not really where they're supposed to be or could be under the old system. The still have this "swoz eat their young" discussion out there. It is certainly not as brutal or mean as it was 30 years ago, not as it was 20 years ago. You get the occasional aberration. I saw someone mention Captain Graf. But folks like that are now an aberration when they were much more common 20 years ago when that idea was coming up.
When you're talking about the learning part of it, the nuts and bolts of being a CO, when you go back to our first guest, Commander Westerwald in the Coast Guard, when you look at the opportunities that he had as a lieutenant commander coming up for command, and if you look back really just a generation for officers in our Navy, where there were opportunities for lieutenant commander command, do you look back as those opportunities would be some way we could recapture that, or are we just really too big to be able to bring back those types of opportunities for your, lack of a better phrase, your really front-running officers to get command early?
We're not too big to do that. We're too short-sighted to do that. And I mean, you look back at what we did building up to Vietnam with the Riverine forces, and after Vietnam, getting rid of all the smaller commands, building them back up again in the 80s, and then as we slowly... We're going to probably not do real well with the modernization for the PCs just because our history is really bad there. We don't have a good PC replacement programmed in right now. We've not done so well with the minesweeping ships. Every now and then people bring up the idea of Zumwalt's Mod Squad as a way of reinvigorating command. But at this point, I don't think that 40 is that old for command anymore. I used to think 40 was really old. It can be done, but we've reached a point where every time we want to fund something, we have to decide what we're going to unfund. And that colors our thinking more than building a coherent force sometimes. And I think I really think we should have more, 100-foot patrol boat, 200-foot patrol boat, national security cutter type things at the 03, 04 command level. And I don't want to jury-rig it the way some folks have talked, where you make LCS and 04 command, they have an 05 Commodore that's there, because then you're just reshuffling the deck chairs. But we really should have a continuum towards command, like guys like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs Staff, when he was coming through. The ability to be a lieutenant and make a mistake. And there's one more thing that's out there, though. We need to not judge those 03 and 04 commanding officers against the exact same standard we judge the 05 commanding officers. If an 03 commanding officer runs aground and didn't do it out of outright negligence, but just a lack of experience, like I know a certain four-star out there who's currently serving did when he was in junior command, we should give those guys an opportunity to learn from that mistake and go on. Instead, what we're doing is the lieutenant in command has all the responsibilities and all the pitfalls of an 05 in command, but when the command tour is done, we are giving them the exact same end-of-tour award that a department head on a ship that has a far deeper bench supporting him and a far greater command structure above him protecting him get. And there's something wrong about that. Command is either command all the way, and you treat it all the way, up one side and down the other, or you don't. We can't do it partially the way we're doing it right now.
Amen. The Nimitz Factor. We have about 90 seconds left. Eagle One, do you have a real quick question to round up the episode?
Sure. Best book for command.
I was afraid you were going to ask me that one. On my best week, I'm reading 3 or 4 books a week, and I lose track sometimes of what I have read. And I will go back to, and this is going to sound really odd, but the books that I've read most often over the course of my life are The Lord of the Rings trilogy and Starship Troopers. And both of them have tremendous leadership lessons for people. And it's not always reading the most applicable thing that's in front of you, but it's about taking those lessons and applying them where you need to. And that is sometimes tougher to do. It's easy to read Red Storm Rising and go, okay, I understand this stuff about naval warfare. It's a lot tougher to look at Aragon and Frodo and say, what leadership lessons did I pull out of this?
Well, that, I did not expect to end on Frodo, but Mike, thank you very much for taking time out of the afternoon, for being third guy in the slot and coming on Mid-Rats. And I wish you and your family the best through the summer.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Same to you guys.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Thank you, everybody, and please join us next week for Mid Wraps, and I hope everybody has a great Navy Day.